You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Governor Walker announced he's seeking applications for the next state Supreme Court justice. We'll talk about the process to replace Justice David Prosser.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
A shooting at a high school prom in Anago made national headlines this week and has led to a discussion about bullying and mental health services in schools.
And the Government Accountability Board is asking for funding to educate Wisconsinites about the state's voter ID law. And some new info came out about an officer-involved shooting in Neenah back in December.
Rob Menser joins us now for more on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks.
So in Anago, some big news made the national headlines about a shooting after a prom. Walk us through the basics of that story.
Sure. So this is something that we've been reporting on aggressively sort of all week. So what happened was on Saturday night, a recently graduated student, he actually graduated last year, named Jacob Wagner, went to the Antico High School prom armed and began to shoot at students in the parking lot. He shot two students, not fatally. A female student was grazed by a bullet and a male student was shot in the leg. And then almost immediately was killed by police who happened to be there patrolling in the school parking lot at the time. There has been a lot since then that has come out about Jacob Wagner and his relationship with the school and the community. We spoke with a number of classmates who said that he was bullied. In the sort of immediacy of the incident, there's a coroner's report the coroner told our reporter that findings suggest that Wagner was actually aiming his gun at the police at the time of the shooting, but there's a lot of questions about, where did he get his gun, what type of gun did he use, that is all in the hands of the Department of Justice now, and we'll have to wait for a report for a lot of those sort of details.
And that's a lot for a town to digest. How has the community responded?
So this case is somewhat different than many other sort of mass shooting cases in that the only dead person is the shooter. There's no other way to say it. That is fortunate. It is of course a tragedy for any loss of life, but this is a situation where things could have been worse. So there's been a lot of praise for the police response and a lot of banding together. And this is a small community, about 8,000 people. They have banded together under a sort of Anago Strong banner. And one thing that our reporter Allison Durr observed and reported on is there's been a lot of sympathy expressed for the family of the shooter, which, again, is you wouldn't necessarily expect to see that, but that has been a quality of this week, and it probably is related to the fact that that he did not succeed in killing other students as he presumably planned to.
Has this changed the conversation or sparked any new procedural insight into the role of police at high schools?
There, it was the police in this case were not stationed at the prom. They were assigned to patrol more frequently. So in a sense, the outcome could have been much worse. There could have been more death as a result of this. There was it was an accident of timing. I think that there is a lot of discussion about do police need to be stationed at one of these public events, but also how does this change the way that high school kids experience these events.
And there was another story this week, an update on another Wisconsin shooting. This update came from dashboard camera video released this week based on a shooting in Neenah back in December. What happened this week?
That's right. Our reporter out of the Appleton Post Crescent, Duke Benke, broke this story. Our organization had over the course of months had filed open records requests for this video of what happened outside a standoff on December 5th. There was a lengthy police standoff for hours and hours outside of Eagle Nation cycles, a motorcycle shop in Neenah. And what happened was one of the hostages, Michael Funk, managed to escape from the building. He was holding a gun at the time, and police, who obviously thought he was the hostage taker rather than one of the hostages, shot him and killed him. So from the start, from the very first public statement that the Neenah police chief made, the story was that police had shouted, police, drop the gun, or some other sort of warning. What is shown on the video that was obtained by USA Today Network Wisconsin is that that did not happen. That was not true. That was misinformation. So in an interview, the Neenah police chief acknowledged this, said that the information came from witnesses immediately after the shooting that was first announced, but the question still remains, why was that never corrected over these months?
And so what happens next with that revelation?
The revelation is that this is released to the public, that that USA Today Network reported this video. The video has been in the hands of the police and of the Department of Justice and other agencies that are involved in the discussion. Like in Anago, is a case where state law requires an independent investigation anytime in Wisconsin law that a police uses fatal force, shoot someone. There's an outside investigation, and so one thing that the Neenah police chief emphasized in his comments immediately after the event and this week was that there is not a legal or policy requirement for officers to give a warning before they shoot when there is an imminent threat. So there's going to be a result of this. Investigation, and I think the question may center on whether there was an imminent threat, whether this was a tragic accident, the police perceived an imminent threat and took action, or whether they should not have fired their weapons.
And our last story this week, Robert, as we recap the state news, is the state's Government Accountability Board has asked the state for money to educate residents on Wisconsin's new voter ID law to launch a campaign there before the November election. What's the story there?
Sure. Remember the voter ID law?
I do.
So this is way back in 2011, and it's been sort of a nonstop fight ever since then, right? So there's a provision in the law that says the state has to fund an education campaign. The state has a role in letting voters know what's going to be required of them and, you know, give them an opportunity to get an ID if they need one. So that makes sense. It makes sense that would be a part of this change. But the legislature never did get around to funding it. I think we all have gotten busy. You have to pick up the kids from school, and before you know it, you forgot to appropriate any funds for the statewide voter education campaign. So this week, the Government Accountability Board submitted their request for $250,000 for this campaign that would be basically concentrated in the months leading up to the fall elections.
And so what are the prospects on this? Has anyone on the joint finance said, yeah, this maybe looks like a good idea or anything the other way?
Yeah, so I think they're going to get it. It was noted that the $250,000 request was a climb down from an initial recommendation of $500,000. And I think that there's been enough sort of public pressure on this issue that it's going to be hard for legislators to avoid it. Robin Voss sort of he didn't sound real enthusiastic about it, the Assembly Speaker, but expressed that that there would be funding for a voter education campaign. So you know, I mean, the people who need to be reached are hard to reach, right? The whole problem with this is that these are people who don't necessarily, follow the news and the ins and outs of what's required. So it's a challenge in that way. But I think the hope is that through some billboards and radio ads and everything else, they may be able to get the word out.
And Robert, if this goes through, would this be kind of one of the last acts of the Government Accountability Board?
Yeah, right. The Government Accountability Board is about to be split in two, and they're still acting as a single agency here. But yeah, there's a time limit on that.
Well, Robert, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
That was editor Robert Menser talking about the biggest stories from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, men aren't always encouraged to be open and honest about their feelings, but our guest psychologist says men can and should share their emotional lives more freely.
First, Governor Scott Walker announced yesterday that he's seeking applications to fill Justice David Prosser's seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Prosser announced he'll be retiring at the end of July. The appointee would stay on the court until 2020 because of laws regarding justice appointments and elections.
For more on this news, Capital Times reporter Caitlin Farrell joins us now to talk about the process. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first off, tell us about the length of this would-be appointment. It's on the long side, right?
Sure, yeah. This justice would be on the bench until 2020. Should give them, and then in April of 2020, they would run to retain their seat, similar to what we saw with Justice Rebecca Bradley, who had been appointed and then ran just earlier this month.
And that appointee, it seems like, would have a large advantage of incumbency with 4 years of decisions. How do you expect that might play into the selection that happens eventually?
Yeah, well, that's something I think that's really people are talking a lot about as they sort of muse and speculate as to who Governor Walker might choose, because I think the thought is that, you know, he wants someone obviously who has a lot of qualifications and has sufficient credentials, but someone that can really have a long career on the court. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely coming into play I sort of reported about that earlier this week, is how young is too young and what's that right balance between a young jurist, a relatively young jurist, and someone who has the appropriate credentials to be on the bench.
Right, and how are governors around the country weighing that question of how young is too young?
Well, it has varied, but what Governor Walker does do, which he established a Justice Selection Advisory Committee, that's a pretty common way that governors go about trying to figure out who they want to appoint. Governor Doyle had one as well, but, you know, the Journal Sentinel reported in an op-ed today, too, that there are other bipartisan methods that apparently other states use as well. So It sort of depends on what you're looking at.
Well, so the Journal Sentinel, the editorial board, had a piece out calling on Governor Walker to appoint a bipartisan commission to recommend would-be appointees. And you said Governor Walker is doing something a little different than that. What is the distinction between the two?
Sure. So, well Governor Walker, I suppose I wouldn't say that he does have a committee. It's I wouldn't cast it at all as a bipartisan commission, but he has a committee mostly made up of private practice attorneys based in Milwaukee. I was just looking through the list. And one of the attorneys, William T. Curran, also served on Doyle's committee. But as far as I can tell, most of the attorneys on that committee do have Republican ties. So I have not found that there's a Democrat there. So the way that Walker's process works, according to his spokesman, is that the committee will do an initial review of applicants. They will talk to local attorneys and judges, and then they will conduct interviews. And then the committee will make a recommendation to the governor's office, and then his chief legal counsel, his deputy legal counsel, would get involved. They'll typically do a second round of interviews, but ultimately the governor will make the final decision. So the committee will make a recommendation, but ultimately it's his call.
So can anyone who's qualified apply? In theory, this isn't the sort of thing like with the United States Supreme Court, where the president can seek out and recruit a candidate.
So it kind of can go both ways. So I think anyone can apply. The governor put out a call yesterday asking for applications and sort of laid out what one needs. Pretty typical resume, cover letter, writing samples. But the governor can approach people as well. I don't see any reason he couldn't, and ask them to apply and sort of find people that way as well. And I think the question that some have, critics of how Walker has appointed jurists in the past, might look at, you know, what do the people of Wisconsin want in a justice? I mean, ostensibly, you want someone who maybe is really the best qualified for that job. And there's people in the camp that think that, you know, having many, many years on the bench is what, you know, really makes someone among the most qualified.
Yeah, it was interesting to see that. This is an appointment for the state Supreme Court, and all the applicant needs is a resume, a cover letter, and writing samples. Kind of expected it to be a little bit more, but I guess this is the way it works.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was a little bit kind of interesting, too. I mean, it's hard to say, I guess, what deliberations behind closed doors look like, and what types of things, you know, are the most important considerations and qualifications for Governor Walker. But, yeah, I mean, I think to the average person, you would imagine that they really are looking for the very best judge in the state. And so it's interesting to discuss about what that means and who that really looks like. So
we're talking with Caitlin Farrell right now, Cap Times public affairs and investigative reporter. We're looking at the process to replace Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice, who's retiring, David Prosser. And Caitlin, you reported on who might appear on Governor Walker's shortlist, likely candidates for this job. Who's at the top of this list?
Sure. So some of the people I've talked to have often been citing Judge Brian Hagedorn as a top contender. He, relatively speaking, is a rather young jurist. He was appointed to the Court of Appeals by Governor Walker in 2015, but he also served as the governor's chief legal counsel from 2011 to 2015 during all of the Act 10 stuff. He also was a clerk for Justice Gableman. He, as far as I'm aware, has not confirmed whether he will be applying or has been tapped. But WisPolitics also had reported that Judge Jim Troupas, he's a Dane County Circuit Court judge, had confirmed he will be applying. I spoke with Judge Randy Koshnick. He ran in 2009 against Justice Abrahamson, and he told me that he will be applying. Judge Koshnick's daughter, Katie Ignatowski, she currently serves as Walker's chief legal counsel, and Judge Koshnick told me that his daughter indicated she will remove herself from that process, the selection process. So those are kind of the top names. Also, I'd heard Mike B. Brennan. He's an attorney in Milwaukee, and he actually currently serves as chair of Governor Walker's Judicial Selection Advisory Committee. But I was told if he does, in fact, apply, he would, you know, remove himself also from that selection process.
So you've got a short list of people right now who look like likely contenders for this position. And, you know, we assume that these candidates are going to be conservative. Do you know what sort of justice the governor is looking for? Is he presumably considers a conservative justice to fill that seat?
Right. I wouldn't go so far to speculate onto what specifically Governor Walker might be looking for, but for people who are following his patterns, I mean, he has had a pattern of nominating and appointing judicially conservative, they would describe it, judiciously conservative judges to the bench. And I think that many people think there's no reason to believe that he would divert from the pattern that we've seen from him since he's been in office. And as I reported to yesterday, there's real variances into, you know, different conservative approaches.
Right. Yeah. Can you take us through some of those conservative approaches, and maybe if you have any thoughts about what Governor Walker might be considering in the footsteps of Judge Prosser, that would be interesting too.
Sure. Well, and I think comparing, you know, or looking at who Walker might choose compared with the legacy of Prosser is somewhat interesting. There are those who say that Prosser, particularly early in his career, was somewhat of an unpredictable vote. He wasn't always reliably in the conservative camp. And so it's somewhat interesting to think about whether Walker would appoint someone who maybe would be an unpredictable swing. I don't know that many people think that he will actually do that. But you have people who sort of look at judicial conservatives in two different camps. You have one that had been modeled more after the Justice Scalia camp, which looks at the Constitution, would understand the law, looking at the Constitution in just a really kind of fundamentalist word-for-word understanding, not really looking at all between intentions of the framers or interpretations, but really just the plain language of what the law says. They would be textual originalists. And then you have folks more sort of in who sees the Robert Bork camp, who might consider like historical context or sort of the psychological background or context of the framers of the Constitution and sort of try to understand and interpret the law through those lenses. So there are some distinctions between how we understand people more ideologically to the right might read the law. So some folks argue that those distinctions really make a difference, and others say that really at the end of the day they don't, because there's still going to be an ideological conservative majority there. So,
and Caitlin, how long do you think this process is going to last, and what is the next step?
I really have no idea how long the process may last. I mean, the next step. I know that applications are going to be accepted. The governor's office said that they will be accepting them until May 19th. I'm not sure. Prosser has said that he will retire in July. So the session then, Supreme Court session will end. And so I imagine that Walker will seat someone, you know, to be ready for the next session. But hard to say when exactly we might hear about that. So,
Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell, the Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter, talking about the process to replace Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice David Prosser.
Coming up, we'll look at the emotional lives of boys and men. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's NPR's political junkie Ken Rudin. He'll have the latest on this week's round of primaries, Ted Cruz's running mate, and more. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, there are a lot of expectations of men, how they should act and what they should and shouldn't show externally. Those ideas about what it means to be a man can be imposed by society and then internalized during boyhood and carried on into adult life.
Psychologists, sociologists, and educators are looking at the conditioning that boys and men face. They've found it can be bad for men's academic performance, emotional and physical well-being, and bad for society in general.
Niobe Way joins us now. She's professor of developmental psychology at New York University and is the author of Deep Secrets, Boys' Friendships and the Crisis of Connection. Niobe, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, how would you describe the messages that men and boys get about what being a man, what being masculine is?
Well, you know, I mean, it trumps in all different shapes and sizes, but it's a fundamental theme, which is that we think that anything related to showing emotions or having emotions or being emotionally astute or wanting relationships, all these sort of fundamental human things, are somehow, according to the boys who I've interviewed over many decades, are girly and gay. And so the ways we've made masculinity is that we've constructed it so that it's something that doesn't entail emotional or vulnerability or relationships. So it's a pretty lonely image, in fact. And that's what the boys themselves tell me, is that they're, you know, as they get older and the pressures increase to act like a man, to man up, they also talk about being very isolated and lonely. Because we need those things. We need our emotions and our relationships to thrive. So it creates all sorts of problems.
I think there's a common idea that, it's natural. Men are born that way. That's just how we're wired. But in talking to boys of different ages, you say no, up to a point where we men are really emotional. We're seeing those connections. And we're constructed as we age to be less emotional. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, that's the story of my work over the past 25 years, is that what was extraordinary to me starting in the late 80s, I was a high school counselor at a high school in Boston, and I started to hear these remarkable boys speaking in incredibly emotionally astute and sophisticated ways about their friendships and about their relationships. And I realized that story wasn't being told, and then I've spent the last 25 years listening to boys. And what you hear from boys 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 in particular is just incredible, incredible acuity. I mean, just boys able to read the emotional world, the human world, in an incredibly profound way, and then being very explicit about wanting things that they're not supposed to want. So, for example, intimacy in, you know, in their friendships with other boys, wanting deep secrets, wanting to share deep secrets with their friends. And then what happens is that as they get the pressures to be men and to grow up and act like a man, they're sort of emotional voices, they're vulnerable voices. They oftentimes use the word love in reference to their close friends when they're younger. They start to become the boys that we see as stereotypes. So they start talking about not caring anymore. They have more anger in their voices, more expressions of isolation, and that they start equating that desire for intimacy, emotional intimacy with other boys, as somehow gay and dysfunctional. And for straight boys, they want to distance themselves from that category, of course, in a very homophobic society. So the idea is that it really is the pressures to be a man that creates the loss. And I would say very bluntly, it's really American culture. It's American masculinity that really puts the pressure on boys to not sound like girls. And what girls sound like, of course, is human voices. It's being emotionally vulnerable. It's wanting relationships, all those kinds of things that is really just fundamentally a human thing. And you hear it from little kids, too, by the way. You know, all parents will tell beautiful stories about their sons and daughters that say things, you know, that say beautiful, honest, open things about the world. They notice things. And then we squash it because we somehow give it a gender rather than saying it's a human thing.
We're talking with New York University professor Niobe Wade, talking about how boys and men are conditioned to suppress and reject their emotions and why it's not good for men or women or society. And Niobe, what are some of the consequences of what you're seeing here that boys learning to squash down their emotions and disassociate from them?
Yeah, I'll tell you, they're very obvious consequences. So one of the things that we found in our data is that right at the time in which boys start to sort of say the I don't care statements and express more anger in terms of when you ask them about their own thoughts of themselves and their relationships and their school, there starts to be much more discussion of frustration and anger, is about 15 and 16. And that's exactly the age that the suicide rate among boys jumps up to be about 5 times the rate of girls before it's about 3 times the rate. And you see suicide happening there in incredibly high percentages among boys. You see mass violence, almost all the mass violence we've seen across this country happens, is committed by boys between 16 and 22. Just an incredible kind of anger directed at themselves and other people. And then you hear these, you know, I have to share a very quick story that says so much. There's a young man who killed a lot of people in Santa Barbara. I don't know if you remember that case a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And he says to the camera the night before he kills all these people, he's about 19 or 20 in the video, and he says, I'm going to kill all these people tomorrow because it's against all you humanity who's let me rot in my own loneliness. And obviously the boy is mentally disturbed, obviously. But he really picks up on a theme that I hear a lot from boys, which is that sense is that they're, you know, they really want to be able to have these deep, intimate relationships with other men and women as well, of course. And we turn them into, you know, we dehumanize them by saying that, in fact, if you have those human emotions, you're somehow not a man. And so it really has, you know, suicide, I would say violence, self-directed or other-directed, is the real consequence of what we do to our boys. And, you know, we shouldn't be surprised if we're born as human, you know, emotional human beings, and then we raise them to not be that. So we really shouldn't be surprised that some of our boys end up sort of going crazy, from not being encouraged to sort of act in their full humanity.
These messages are coming from our parenting, our peers as we grow up, and it's all over our pop culture. So given that it's so all over the place, where do you even start to try to fix that, to change that?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news is that, everyone always thinks my findings are really depressing, but I actually find the findings really uplifting because what it shows is it's just a human capacity that we squash rather than, you know, Rob not existing from the start. So the goal for parents and teachers and professionals and mentors and all sorts of folk, is to nourish those in boys when they have it so clearly. And so in our young boys, in our, you know, teenage boys, to really nourish their emotional lives and to have conversations about their friendships and your own friendships as parents, modeling what it means to, you know, to have good relationships, talking about relationships, talking about the struggles that happen in relationships, and all those kinds of things that can help our boys hold on to their, what I would call, again, their core humanity, which is just, you know, hold on to their sort of emotional intelligence that they have about the world. And so there's all sorts of things that, you know, parents can do in terms of around the dinner table when they're taking a family trip, when they're riding in the car with their sons, in terms of having different conversations, and also just modeling it. You know, I try very hard. I'm a parent of two teenagers, and I'm a boy and a girl. And I try very hard to even talk about the challenges I have in my friendships so that they see that friendships are not always just fun. They can entail struggle and conflict and how I work through the conflict. As teachers, I work with teachers in a middle school right now trying to get conversations as part of the curriculum, like in the English classroom, for example, that talking about love, talking about friendships and love and friendships as part of what you investigate in a novel or what you investigate in, you know, whatever you're reading as a text. And so that it becomes a normal thing, something that's just a normal part of life, that we think about these things and we nourish them. And I think, you know, you have all sorts of programs across the country that are doing effective things like this. And we just need to, you know, honestly, Rob and Veronica, we just need to take, you know, take it more seriously as something we urgently, urgently need to help our children grow into thriving adults.
Niobe, I noticed you use the phrase hang on to their emotional lives instead of, you know, restore. What about boys who are older? We just briefly, because I want to get to some callers, but
yeah,
is it difficult? Is it possible to reinstate that sort of emotional fluency once it may have been lost or pushed down?
Yeah. So I see it a lot. So the book, my book, Deep Secrets, people will have written me across the country. They've read the book and they've said, oh, you're telling my story. This is my story. And it's men from 18 to 80 will say, yeah, this is my story. And they'll really, once they see that it's normal, that these desires and this story is normal, that is what boys and men want, they're very quickly able to connect to that stuff that they had when they were younger. And so you see that, you even see it a transformation sometimes within one class period, where once men realize this is not exceptional, this is not weird, this is not some kind of, you know, you are emotional, but most men are not. That men are very quick to oftentimes, not all the time, obviously, but oftentimes able to reconnect to that basic human capacity.
We're talking with New York University's Niobe Way about how boys and men are conditioned to suppress and reject their emotions and why it's not good for them, for women, or for society. She's the author of the book Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection.
You can call in now at 800-642-1234. If you're a man, do you have these close emotional male friendships? Have they fallen away as you've aged? What was the turning point? Do you miss having that closeness with other men? If so, what are the obstacles? If you're the parent of boys or you teach them, when does it change? How do you see them act differently as they become aware of messages about what it means to be a man? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation now with Niobe Way, professor of applied psychology at New York University and the author of the book Deep Secrets, Boys, Friendships, and the Crisis of Connection.
Taking a look at how boys and men are negatively impacted by societal messages about masculinity and emotions. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Is it your son's story or your student's story? When does it change? When do men stop, boys and men stop expressing themselves? Have you gotten through this, broken through, and you feel like you've got a handle on expressing your emotions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Julia on the line in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I just driving home from work and turned on the radio and heard this. I mean, I have a 16-year-old son. Boy, it's like the story was written in regards to him. I mean, just over this past year or so, you know, me trying to check in with him about emotions and kind of a transition time. His best friend's a senior. He's a junior, and his friend's kind of going off in a different direction. And a lot of anger coming out of my son. But I think overall that our society really does encourage this thing of at very young ages of young men, 16 and so forth, to not express those emotions. Now, I've had the ability to have some discussion with him and have him at one point break down and cry and share some of his feelings. But how, as a parent, do we continue to encourage this conversation and to let them know it's okay? Because there were times that I felt like he was really withholding a lot of feelings. And yes, my thoughts went to, boy, I know that there's an increase of suicide around, you know, that 16 to 20-year-old of age. And
right. It's an important question when you look at some of the consequences there. Julia, thank you for bringing that up. And how do you, as a parent, help your son when you see them going through something like this, Niobe?
Well, I mean, I think that the main answer, I mean, it's obviously there's multiple things. And it sounds like, first of all, her name's Julia. Is that right?
Yes.
She's doing a beautiful job in terms of having these conversations with her son. So first of all, I want to give her some nice feedback on that. But I think that the other thing to just remember is to just normalize these feelings. I mean, it sounds like it's a sort of lame response to her question, but it's really the response, which is that so many boys, so many young men, you know, by now I've talked to thousands and I get calls all the time and emails, et cetera, is that they think they're alone in this process. They think they're the only ones that feel this way, or the only ones that are struggling, or the only ones who want friendships and can't find the kind of friendships that they want. And you know, it's just remarkable when I now speak to teenage boys, whole, you know, schools of them. What's remarkable is that consistently someone says, you know, for example, one boy said to me once, "Who did you write this book for?" And I said, "Well, I wrote it for teachers and parents." And he said, "Why didn't you write it for us?" And I said, "Why do you say that?" And he said, "Because then we would feel less alone." And the whole thing is that what they're asking is, let us know that this is normal, you know, that all young men basically feel this way, different degrees, obviously, there's variation. But, you know, that this is a normal thing. So I would show your son, you know, I mean, even show them what, you know, have them listen to this radio show. I mean, you know, have them listen, read. There's blogs on the Internet about it. I mean, I've written blogs for Huffington Post. I mean, there's all sorts of information out there that's saying that this is really normal. And so once they feel like it's normal, then somehow I see the transition with my own son, who's also 16, by the way, is that that helps him a lot to know that he's not a weirdo, which is what, you know, all 16-year-old boys are panicked about.
And we'll leave it there. Niobe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, good. Okay, wonderful.
That's Niobe Way. She's a professor of applied psychology at New York University. She's the author of the book Deep Secrets, Boys' Friendships and the Crisis of Connection. Tree planting ceremonies were held across the state today to celebrate National Arbor Day. This morning in Milwaukee, school children planted a burr oak along a bike trail. But there's trouble on the forestry front. The emerald ash borer continues to chew its way across Wisconsin and is killing ash trees in about 40 counties. The invasive bug has even made its way into those places of leafy tranquility nature centers. Chuck Krumbach prepared this report.
Children and birds sound off outside the visitors hall at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. This site in Bayside, just north of Milwaukee, draws thousands of people each year to its 185 acres of forests, trails, and ponds along Lake Michigan. 35% of the tree cover is ash. Conservation Director Mark White says that hasn't been a problem until about a month ago.
We found it here this March for the first time.
It is the emerald ash borer, or more specifically, the larvae of the insect, which gets under the bark of the ash and disrupts the tree's flow of nutrients. That leads to what's called girdling, and over the course of a few years, a dead tree. Armed with a hammer and flathead screwdriver, White peels back some bark on an infested ash.
We're getting right down to the cambium layer, and look at that, right underneath that bark, right in the phloem, right where they're supposed to be, that's where they are. So this tree has been almost entirely girdled.
White says for safety and aesthetic reasons, Schlitz Audubon will have to take down the tree and probably 1,000 or 2,000 more ash over the next couple of years. White says Schlitz Audubon hopes to replace the ash by planting 1,000 to 2,000 trees of other species per year for the next decade. He says the potential price tag, even with a lot of volunteers, is $1.7 million. Steep, perhaps, but Schlitz has a mission.
Our goal is to try to have a refuge for biotic diversity, for people to see what a really high-quality, intact native ecosystem should look like.
Schlitz Audubon is not the first Wisconsin Nature Center to battle the ash borer bug. Land manager Matt Smith walks on a wooden bridge over a swampy area at the River Edge Nature Center near Newburgh. He's heading towards some of the ash trees the emerald ash borer started killing about a decade ago. Smith points at a tree broken off in mid-trunk, leaning against living trees.
You can see this is the sort of wild condition that you would want in your woods. This is probably every raccoon in this area has crawled up this log and come up into that tree.
Smith says River Edge is leaving alone some dead ash that are not a safety concern, but he says with about 15% of the tree cover at River Edge's 375 acres having been ash, many trees have been taken out, and more will be cut soon. But Smith says some have survived the pest invasion.
There is some hope. We do see some struggling trees still remaining on the landscape, and what they represent is a genetic stock that is worth saving and trialing for breeding trials.
But Smith says River Edge is also well into a program to plant other species of trees. He says turnover is common in nature.
Things mature, and so as we age, our forests are aging too, and the oak trees that are in this area that are now released from competition from ash are going to be bigger.
Smith says private landowners who are dealing with the loss of ash in their yard can maybe be inspired by the nature centers and by Arbor Day to pick diverse and native species to plant. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.